So at what point are you told explicitly about what your family was engaged in? When is it described to you and how?
Oh, I think I learned about it from before I could talk.
This is Dave Belden.
So I had these nightmares when I was 4 years old about the world coming to an end. One was where I was out in space and I was looking at the world and I saw an explosion happen in the center of the planet, and then the planet would come apart and huge shards of the planet, huge sort of quarters and eighths and so on of the planet would fly out into space, and I would wake up screaming and screaming. And I've thought a lot about why I had those nightmares. And I think part of the reason is what I was hearing all the time from my parents, my family. We were all engaged in, quote unquote, remaking the world. And there was a tremendous urgency about our work. Everybody was hyped up and intense about it. And I think that I felt the urgency of changing the world from a very young age.
Dave Belden was born into an organization that was especially active in the middle of the 20th century called Moral Rearmament, or MRA. It was a Christian organization that some of its own members would eventually describe as a cult. MRA members believed that they were remaking the world by convincing powerful people, politicians, labor leaders, CEOs, etc., to be guided by conscience and to listen to God. I had never heard of Moral Rearmament before I met Dave. But now that I know a little bit more about the work they were engaged in at the peak of their influence, I can see why they truly believed they were, in fact, remaking the world. I'm Lloyd Lockridge, and this is Family Lore.
We lived in a big house in London. There were like 16 or 20 of us in the Mayfair district of London, very posh area. Mm. These were old aristocratic houses that you might have seen on Downton Abbey.
Growing up, Dave and his sister lived in this house with their parents and a bunch of other Moral Rearmament members. It had all the superficial signs of a charmed life.
Just to give you an idea of the location, our local park was Green Park, which has Piccadilly, the street Piccadilly, on one side, and Buckingham Palace on the other side. And there was an occasion, which I actually remember, when I was probably about 4 years old, and we were walking rather sedately in the park, and I went up to a little boy, and I said, "Hello." And the boy said absolutely nothing to me. And he had a nurse with a great big black pram next to him, and after a little, the nurse said, "Say hello to the little boy, Prince Charles."
Living in this neighborhood, among the most rich and powerful people in London, was a strategic decision by MRA's founder, an American man named Frank Bookman.
We were leading a sort of upper-class lifestyle in order to reach the up and outs. I don't know if you know the phrase down and outs. Down and outs was a phrase for people on Skid Row. Up and outs was what Frank Bookman called the sort of wealthy and powerful people who actually were as spiritually bereft as the people out on Skid Row and who needed God and who needed to come to God. And they were going to be converted in houses like ours. One of the enduring goals of the movement was to win over the British establishment. And he had a very grandiose concept of how individual change could actually resolve conflicts between nations.
Frank Bookman was an ordained Lutheran pastor who was also influenced by the evangelical revivalist movement. And he believed that many of the world's conflicts could be solved if powerful people would just spend more time listening to God.
Listening to your inner voice, your voice of conscience, you didn't really have to believe in God to begin with from his point of view, but you had to listen to your conscience.
As Dave grew up, conflicts between him and his sister were settled in the same way conflicts were dealt with in the larger movement. He remembers one physical fight with his sister over a ball in which his mother told them both to go to their rooms and listen to God and come back and tell her what they'd heard.
Apparently what she remembered was that I, at 5 years old or something, said, "God told me that we should take our ball and kick the ball and not each other." We were never punished that I remember, certainly never smacked or anything like that. Instead, I was always told to listen to God. And so I had this sort of extremely fine-tuned conscience from a very early age.
Dave was thrilled when he was finally old enough to join MRA's morning meetings, where they would discuss conflicts that were happening around London and how they could get solved.
Things like people saying, well, there's a strike brewing down in the docks, and we think that we could probably bring some resolution to that. I mean, this is why the left really hated them, because the left was trying to brew up conflict to try and actually get better conditions for the workers. But MRA thought you got better conditions for the workers by changing the employers and getting them out of their conscience to give better wages and conditions. I know that people on the left thought that they were horrendously conservative. Mm. What I learned as a child was that both sides were materialistic and everybody needed God. And we were the ones who God had chosen to change the whole world.
MRA members, like Dave's parents, were supposed to be out in the world meeting people and inviting them into the practice of listening to God.
I think that a skillful member of the movement would be just getting into conversation with somebody that they were interested in, and they might share their own story. This is what happened to me. This is how I changed.
And this kind of sharing might inspire the other person to share something in return.
And this woman might say, oh my God, we got all this problem with my husband and he's an impossible guy. And MRA woman might say, well, I just realized that if I think the blame is 90% his and 10% mine, well, I can at least put right my 10%.
And this represents an important aspect of Moral Rearmament's approach to resolving conflict. The organization placed a lot of emphasis on learning to apologize.
You know, there's all this sort of homey wisdom about what you can do to apologize first and try to make amends. And how do you know what to do? Well, you have to just sit down and listen. And would you like to do that with me?
The people they were inviting to do this were in London's upper crust. And so they came, the rich and powerful, in and out of Dave's childhood home in their tailored suits and dresses, to learn to apologize, to listen to God, and to discuss what their consciences were telling them.
So we might have 50 people for dinner, or even 100 people for dinner. We had this huge drawing room upstairs, and my father would be making speeches.
Dave's mom, on the other hand, had a different job. She had a degree in psychology from London University, but women were not allowed to take leadership roles in MRA, so she ran the kitchen.
She worked out, I put this in my book, but I think it was served 26,000 meals in the course of 1 year, something like that.
If you can invite powerful people to listen to God about something personal like a marital problem, maybe the practice would transfer for bigger decisions with higher stakes. That was the idea. And it wasn't just an idea. Before they owned the house in London, in the years right after World War II, MRA members convened some of the most powerful people in the world to heal one of its deepest wounds. In the years following World War II, the European continent was in ruins. Cities across Britain, Germany, Poland, France, the Netherlands, and the Soviet Union had been leveled. Tens of millions were dead, including 6 million Jews. In the aftermath, Europe was split into two blocks. The Soviets were imposing communism across Eastern Europe, and America and Great Britain were trying to keep the Western bloc of countries united with each other and against communism. Germany, after the war, had been divided, one side being controlled by the Soviets and the other by the Allied powers. But what to do about Germany was a huge question. There was more than enough reason to punish Germany to the fullest possible extent. At the same time, leaders were painfully aware that it was the punitive measures following World War I which led to Hitler's rise. Many of the Allied countries, particularly France, did not believe it was possible to invite Germany to join in a united Europe after all it had done. But they had to do something. Rejecting Germany entirely would make it vulnerable to communism. This was the backdrop of moral rearmament's biggest moment.
So there was a Swiss diplomat, Philippe Motu.
Motu was an MRA member.
And after the war was over, he decided that because Switzerland had been spared the devastation of the war, it had to do something, and he collected 100 Swiss families who got together and bought a decrepit old hotel high in the Alps above Montreux, above the Lake of Geneva. So they bought this hotel, they cleaned it up, and they started fanning out across Europe, inviting people to come to post-war conferences.
The conferences were meant to facilitate European reconstruction and reconciliation. The need for reconstruction was obvious, but reconciliation was a more novel idea, and to some, unfathomable. To MRA, however, reconciliation was paramount.
And my parents responded to the call to go to Switzerland and help build this conference center and so on. So I was actually born in 1949 in Bern, the capital of Switzerland. Philippe Motu was my godfather. I called him Uncle Philippe.
One of the people invited to the hotel in the Swiss Alps was a French woman named Irene Lohr. When the Germans had occupied her country, Lohr had been a leader in the resistance against them. She and her family had suffered greatly during the war.
Her children had been malnourished. Her oldest boy had been tortured by the Gestapo. She was a Marxist, an atheist, a very passionate, fierce woman. And after the war, she was elected to go to Paris as a member of parliament. Two guys show up at her office in Paris, and one of them had been in the resistance, and they say, "We're starting this conference to rebuild Europe, and we would like to invite you to come, and it's up in this lovely place in the Alps." And she said, all right, because she thought her children needed some lovely fresh air and some good milk from Swiss cows and, and so on. So she went to this conference and was absolutely horrified to learn one day that a party of Germans were coming to the conference. This was at a time when no hotel in Europe would accept a party of Germans, I mean, outside of Germany.
But MRA founder Frank Buchmann and Dave's godfather Philippe believed that including the Germans in a conversation about how to rebuild Europe was not only tolerable, but necessary. This was not a popular idea, nor was it logistically simple.
In fact, they had approached the British, French, and American occupation forces in Germany and got permission for all kinds of leading Germans to leave the country to come to this conference center. And Irene Lohr hears that the first party is about to arrive, and she packs her bags and is on the way out of the hotel when she's accosted, as it were, by Frank Buchmann, who says, "Madame, as a socialist, how can you imagine building a new Europe without the Germans?"
Irene Lohr, the story goes, recognized some kernel of truth in this, and she took her bags and her children back to her hotel room.
And she stays there, apparently, 3 days and nights without food, wrestling with her own absolute hatred of the Germans.
In MRA terms, Irene Lohr was doing the important work of listening to God, or in other words, listening to her own conscience.
And finally, she comes out to eat, and a woman in MRA says, "Would you like to meet a German, madame?" And she says, "All right." And she finds herself at a lunch table with one of the widows of one of the men who had been executed for attempting to kill Hitler. And this woman apologizes to her. She says, "We didn't do enough early enough to prevent Hitler, and I'm sorry." And Irene Lohr replies, I think what she says is something like, "Would you pray with me?" Which is a surprising thing to come from the mouth of an atheist. Because she's realized that she needs some power greater than herself to get rid of this hatred. And later she said that's the moment at which the bridge across the Rhine was built. When she had this, I'm feeling tearful telling you this because it's deeply meaningful to me. It's how people who have been so consumed by hatred can try to transcend it.
This story would become one of the defining narratives of MRA. It was repeated over and over as a kind of parable affirming the power of its methodology.
A little bit later, Irene Law gets up on the platform in the conference and says that she wants to apologize to the Germans present for the amount of hatred that she had for them, not for being in the resistance, of course, not for opposing them, but for the hatred that she felt, which in itself would prevent the creation of a new united Europe.
Following this time in Switzerland, Irene Lohr would make her way across Europe, speaking some 200 times in public and appearing in 11 of the 12 European state parliaments, saying in one speech, quote, "Our task is to take the first step toward the Germans so that what happened before can never happen again." The German chancellor of the 1950s, a man named Konrad Adenauer, said that Irene Lohr and her husband were, quote, "the couple which did the most over the last 15 years to build unity between the two countries," meaning Germany and France, "which had been enemies for centuries." Eventually, some of the politicians who had attended those MRA conferences in Switzerland, including Chancellor Adenauer and Foreign Minister Robert Schuman, would help create the European Coal and Steel Community,
whereby France and Germany and some smaller countries, but particularly France and Germany, unified their armaments-making industries, their steel and coal, so that they could never go to war with each other again. And this was after the two world wars and before that, the Franco-German War. Hundreds of millions of people had died in these wars, and they came to their own voluntary decision. I'm not ascribing this to Mauriomet, but Frank Buchmann was decorated by both French and German governments for the work that he had done, because you have the politicians creating their plans on the one hand, but are people actually going to agree? It's like there needs to be a degree of reconciliation for people to be able to do that.
Would you say that this moment in the MRA's history would represent the peak of its influence?
I think so, yes. I think this was when they really came into their own. They were having this huge influence, and yet within the movement, things were not going that well.
In 1952, Dave's family left Switzerland and moved back to London and into the big house in the Mayfair district that you heard about at the beginning of this episode. Their commitment to the cause was total, which was expected of all full-time MRA members. And although Dave didn't realize it at the time because he was just a kid, the organization was becoming increasingly tyrannical.
In the 1950s, there started to be a kind of witch hunt period in the movement.
MRA members had always been expected to spend an hour each morning listening to God and writing down the thoughts that came to them. These notes were then shared with other members. This system, at its best, was meant to keep you accountable to yourself and to your community. But at its worst, it acted as a means of surveillance and control. Members who expressed doubts about the movement during these sessions might find themselves suddenly facing accusations.
A very common accusation was that if someone was having doubts about the movement or the strategy or was being critical of Buchmann or this or that, they were considered to be falling down on what we call the second standard, i.e. purity, i.e. they were probably having sex that they shouldn't have, or maybe they were having homosexual desires. And this was became a huge bugbear in the movement, was accusing people of being homosexual. So my dear Uncle Philippe, this amazing man who had started the conference center at Co, was accused of homosexuality because he had not done something that Buchmann wanted him to do, which pretty much drove Philippe out of the movement and in fact drove him to a nervous breakdown.
But homosexuality wasn't the only sexual behavior MRA policed and prohibited.
People were expected to only have sex for procreation, and they could only have children if the MRA team agreed that they could. So I felt unbelievably sad for my parents, who were totally in love with each other, really amazingly, for 50 years or more. I mean, it was quite sweet to see. And it really bothered me that they actually hadn't had sex since I was conceived. I thought, damn, what was that about?
But this kind of questioning would come later. When Dave was growing up, he was still very dedicated to the movement and eager to find his place in it, which was how, at 18 years old, he ended up taking a trip to India that would change his outlook forever.
The leader of MRA in India was Rajmohan Gandhi, who was one of the grandsons of Mahatma Gandhi, and was a very charismatic character in his own right. And he was at a youth conference. He came to visit a youth conference of MRA in England and asked for volunteers to help out with their work in India.
Dave volunteered. In India, he encountered a world beyond the one he'd come from. It was a world of new colors, new religions, new customs, and poverty like he'd never witnessed before. One day, he was asked to go on an errand. A young Indian woman who had come to visit the MRA conference center needed to return to her village, and Dave was asked to accompany her.
It was a 3-day, 2-night train trip, third class, and this was a kind of stunning experience for me as this 18-year-old religious boy, white boy. The train was so crowded that there were men underneath my feet and on the luggage racks above my head. And everybody else was able to sit cross-legged on these wooden boards, which is why people could be sitting down in the well between the seats. But I couldn't, because I was an overweight boy raised on chairs. And I had to stick my legs straight out in front of me, sort of on the shoulders of the men below, which was the most embarrassing possible thing.
This train ride and Dave's whole time in India made a deep impression on him. MRA didn't seem to have a good answer for solving the kind of poverty he was seeing there. When he came back from India, he enrolled at Oxford. It was 1968. He was still dedicated to MRA, but he was starting to have doubts.
I would write private notes on a little notebook that I had that I wouldn't show anybody, because in MRA you're supposed to confess your sins, but not really your doubts.
He did have one friend with whom he could talk about his doubts, a black American named Beemore Franklin.
Beemore was his nickname. He was from Baltimore. And Beemore and I became unlikely friends somehow. And he was telling me one day about how people had got up in the cinema where he was watching a movie, and they'd got up and moved away. And I said, I didn't know that you would be having racist put-downs like that here. And I said, do you tell people about this? And he said, no, I'm just telling you. And I said, why are you telling me? And he said, oh, because you're from another oppressed minority. And I said, I am. I was this white guy who had been to this posh private school. And he said, yes, everybody hates MRA.
To the young leftists at Oxford, MRA was an out-of-touch, anti-labor organization. Its members were weird and culty.
Beemore Franklin was the first guy that gave me a glimpse that, oh, a friend is someone you can just be honest with. A friend is someone you say actually how it is for you.
What was your concept of friendship before meeting Beemore Franklin? What was a friend to you?
A fellow fighter for God.
During his years at Oxford, Dave would become increasingly pessimistic about MRA and its strategies for changing the world. On one trip home from college, he told his father he was so hopeless about the movement that he felt suicidal. Dave would later learn that his father harbored his own doubts about the movement.
After he died, and I was cleaning up his house, I found this diary that he had written when I had been about 14, when he had talked about all his doubts about the movement. It's so similar to me writing my thoughts privately. And in the diary, he said, I can't talk to Stella, my mother. He said, I can't talk to her about it. And I thought, damn, Dad, you're having all these doubts? I mean, serious doubts. He was thinking of leaving the movement at that time.
And maybe this partly explains why, as Dave drifted farther and farther from MRA over the next few years, his parents didn't put up much of a fight. By the early 1970s, he was basically out of the organization. There was never a formal split, just a slow realization for Dave and his parents that his life was taking a different shape. In 1972, he and a handful of other Oxford students founded an organization dedicated to ending global poverty, and he would spend the next several years committed to that cause. In 1976, Dave would publish a graduate thesis on MRA, which is still, to this day, some of the most thorough academic writing that exists on the subject. It was only while doing this writing that he realized the organization he'd grown up in looked a lot like a cult.
The charismatic leader who's given way too much leeway and obedience and respect, that was true for Frank Bookman. The demonization, other people, the us and them quality. I mean, we had thought that we were the changed people and we were God's troops in the world and everybody else was the unchanged. It was awful. It was a cult in certain ways, but it was also a cult that was doing good work in the world, which is kind of confusing because we think of cults as just sort of bad and horrible and wrong.
And that's the thing. Dave still believes that MRA did a lot of good in the world. And for better or worse, he is a product of his upbringing in the organization. He may be looking through a different lens now, but he's seeing with the same eyes.
So one thing it definitely bequeathed me was just an obsession with trying to change the world. I mean, that'll be with me till I die, I'm sure. I'm just a restless soul who constantly has to be involved in something that's working to change the world.
Dave has spent much of his adult life in leftist movements, looking for the work that felt like the best fit for him. And where he's landed in the last several years is a place that actually has some things in common with MRA. Tell me, what is restorative justice?
In our normal justice system, we break the law, we're punished for it. That's what the law asks. What rule or what law was broken? What was the punishment? And restorative justice asks a completely different set of questions. It says, who was hurt? Whose obligation is it to put right that hurt? And how can we move forward with healing?
Healing conflict was, of course, a core focus of MRA, too. But Dave says in MRA, it was all about individual change and took a kind of top-down approach.
It was trying to heal, in many ways, heal the rich and powerful in the world.
Restorative justice is community-based. When a harm is committed, it requires the community and family members to be part of the process of accountability and healing.
When people who've done harm can feel empathy for the people that they harmed and really take seriously accountability for themselves, what do I need to do to change? And then as we recover personally, how can we struggle to change the systems around us? So for example, in New Zealand, where the Maori people, the indigenous people, said too many of our young people are in prison, they instituted a whole different approach in New Zealand where they eventually closed their juvenile detention centers and young people who had committed crimes went to family group conferences where they met with the person that they had harmed.
As Dave was talking about the family group conferences in New Zealand, where the people who had caused harm met with people they'd harmed, it was impossible not to think of Irene Lohr, the Frenchwoman who not only came to accept the presence of Germans at a post-war conference in Switzerland, but actually apologized for harboring so much hatred towards them, despite all they had done. This was the foundational story of MRA, and the one that profoundly shaped Dave's life. When we asked him if he felt if he'd come full circle, he said that it felt more like a spiral going upwards, meaning there was something circular about it, but he hadn't simply returned to the beginning. He was always changing, moving forward. Even if, at almost 80 years old, Dave is still engaged in the work he's known since before he can remember. The work of remaking the world. Thank you for listening to Family Lore. If you have stories you'd like to share about your family, please email me at familylorepod@gmail.com. That's familylorepod@gmail.com. Family Lore is an Odyssey original podcast It is written and narrated by me, Lloyd Lockridge. Our executive producers are Leah Reese Dennis and I. Our lead producer and sound editor is Zach Clark. Our story editor and co-writer of this episode is Katie Mingle. Additional sound editing, mixing, and mastering by Chris Basil, and production support by Sean Cherry. Special thanks to Maura Curran, Josephina Francis, Kurt Courtney, Hillary Schuff, and Laura Berman. If you're interested in learning more about David Belden's life and work, you can order his memoir, The World Remaker's Child, a memoir of activism and healing. Thanks again for listening to Family Lore. And if you have time, we'd love for you to rate and review the show.